In this news roundup of the week for 5th of August 2022, China responds with fury to the visit by US House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan. The referendum in Kansas pushes back on banning abortion and changes the landscape for the midterm elections. Europe and elsewhere continue to see real consequences to continuing heat waves and drought. And in this week's Short Thought, I reflect on the phenomenon of audience capture and how it pushes creators down a very slippery slope indeed. My name is Malin Baker. This is The Malin Baker Show. US House Speaker Nancy Pelosi provoked the predictable fury of China this week by visiting Taiwan. The visit had originally been scheduled for April this year, when it would have been seen as an attempt to reassure Taipei in the immediate aftermath of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. That visit was postponed when Pelosi caught COVID. Taking place in August, the trip came across within a slightly different context, with Xi Jinping due in months only to be reaffirmed as the leader for life, probably. The question was whether such a provocation would force a Chinese military response, without which Xi might be held to have lost face. Indeed, such concerns were obviously rippling through Pelosi's own party. President Joe Biden said in public that he didn't think the trip was a very good idea. The left-leaning New York Times carried opinion pieces arguing that the trip would be dangerous. Ironically, her most passionate support for the move came from GOP lawmakers who believe that America has to take a firm stand against China's increasing assertiveness internationally. Although that said, other GOP politicians attacked the move as unnecessarily provocative, so it's one of those areas that doesn't necessarily fall neatly along party lines. It was certainly on a lot of people's minds that China's response could go beyond the norm. Not so much because the bomb threat that was made against the Taoyuan International Airport before the visit. Whoever did that didn't know that Pelosi's plane was due to land at a different, smaller airport. But the fact that the Taiwanese military set up anti-aircraft artillery at the airport to shoot down drones or missiles that might try to intercept the plane. Well, that turned out, fortunately, not to be necessary. At the moment when Pelosi's plane landed, the Washington Post released her op-ed making the case for her visit. And she said this: "In the face of the Chinese Communist Party's accelerating aggression, our congressional delegation's visit should be seen as an unequivocal statement that America stands with Taiwan, our democratic partner, as it defends itself and its freedom." As expected, and indeed as promised, China has responded with a show of military strength, although not with immediate action that would necessarily escalate into direct conflict. Alongside the inevitable trappings of conflict in this modern age, hacking attacks against Taiwan's government and various businesses, China announced as Pelosi touched down that it would be conducting live fire operations in various zones around Taiwan, some crossing the line into Taiwan's territorial waters, also Japan's waters as it turned out in practice. Taiwan also saw air incursions by 21 Chinese warplanes on the first day of Pelosi's visit and 27 on the second day. The drills were to run from the 4th of August to the 8th, kicked off on Thursday with multiple ballistic missiles being fired into the waters around the island. The state-run newspaper Global Times said that they would use some of China's most advanced weapons, such as DF-17 hypersonic missiles and J-20 stealth fighter jets. Taiwan's Ministry of National Defense released a statement saying that it would uphold the principle of preparing for war without seeking war. It said that China's drills amounted to a de facto blockade of the island. The G7 foreign ministers pushed back against China's actions with a statement saying, "There is no justification to use a visit as a pretext for aggressive military action in the Taiwan Strait. It is normal and routine for legislators from our countries to travel internationally. The PRC's escalatory response risks increasing tensions and destabilising the region." Now, it was never likely that Pelosi's visit would have nudged China into doing more than they're now doing with those drills. Certainly not in advance of Xi's reconfirmation in post, because nothing's wanted to rock the boat too violently, not least because there's quite a few other issues that the leadership is focused on. But this crisis is built into the current situation. Xi Jinping may well be content to play the longer game with Taiwan, to take the very Chinese strategy of winning the war without fighting the war, which would involve over time destabilising Taiwan's politics, building up the appeal and strength of the pro-Beijing forces on the island, to the point where it would start to become to be seen inevitable that reunion would take place. But that strategy can only work if in the meantime the island doesn't drift further away and its independent status become more concrete. So should America end its One China policy and champion Taiwan as a separate nation, for instance, that would be Xi Jinping's nightmare scenario. So it's not a surprise that in addition to the local show of military force, China has also suspended cooperation with the United States on issues such as climate change, amongst others. It's just reminding the Biden administration, you know, all those things you want our support to address, just consider whether you want those things more than you want to stand by Taiwan. And it's a fair question, given that some commentators have suggested this was more about Nancy Pelosi's US-based political agenda than it was intended specifically to be something that the Taiwanese nation actually felt like wanted to happen. Partly down to Pelosi's bucket list, and she's due to be retiring reasonably soon, and partly down to being seen to be strong on China in advance of the coming midterm elections. Now, this isn't the issue that Democrats are actually hoping will highlight those elections, and certainly not after other events this week. The conservative majority state of Kansas, a state that voted for Trump in 2020 by 15 points, by the way, startled a bunch of people this week by voting to keep abortion protections in the state constitution by a significant margin, 59% to 41%. The outcome brought home to a lot of people what should have always been seen as a strong possibility, that having pushed abortion rights back to the state level, the actual voters in many of those states wouldn't necessarily simply line up with the extreme positions taken by their own political parties. Across the world, people have settled for abortion rules that ban the process after a period of time. 12 weeks in some countries, 15 weeks in others, 24 in the UK. But conservatives generally worldwide don't line up behind the US ideologues who push for zero abortion. There's no particular reason why they would in the US either. However, the scale of the defeat in a solid Republican seat took everyone by surprise, not least the Democrats who had been campaigning on the issue in the state, who'd expected at best a narrow victory, but more likely defeat. Unsurprisingly, Democrats jumped on the results as a signal that if they could put the issue on the ballot for the midterm elections, that could be the factor they need to fend off the feared Republican takeover of the House and the Senate. Well, maybe, but it's not immediately obvious that a ballot proposition, where people get to vote yes or no directly on the issue of substance, necessarily translates into voting for a party, where a lot of other issues and factors are all in the mix. If asked their opinion, conservatives may well say they don't want a total ban on abortion, but would that be a key issue for them so that they would vote for progressive Democrats whose policies on everything else they may thoroughly dislike? The early signs don't seem to suggest it. While Kansas voters went that way on their issue referendum, voters in Arizona, Michigan, and Missouri nominated candidates for top positions who were in favour of stricter abortion restrictions. To all appearances, that is because it is key economic questions, not abortion, that are decisive in how people vote. Months of campaigning still to come, things could change. But one thing you could get from the Kansas result is the fact that Republicans will be slower to presume support for the most radical versions of anti-abortion laws amongst their own voters. And if they can highlight the extreme versions on the other side, then they will be keen to do so. So indeed, this week, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis grabbed attention by suspending a state attorney who refused to prosecute people who tried to provide abortions outlawed by Florida's 15-week ban. 15 weeks, remember, is a time limit in line with those of many European countries who would describe themselves as having legalised abortion. So, very much not on the radical end. Now, there's more on all of this to come. In the autumn, or the fall for our American viewers, Michigan, Montana and Kentucky will also have ballot questions on the issue in the same way. Anything that encourages legislators to be more in touch with their actual voters, probably a good thing. I mean, it's not always a good thing, the justice of the mob and all of that, but when political parties become overly ideological, it's usually a good idea to require them to get their ideas passed in a local vote, you know, just to be sure. And of course, it can become a double-edged sword, particularly for Democrat-dominated states that have policies for abortion with no time limits whatsoever. Abortion right up to the point of birth. Because most people don't tend to support that either. So what sauce of a goose and all of that? Let's make no presumptions about proposed votes in California and Vermont for adding additional abortion options via their constitution. Now, it's possible that the outcome will actually dissuade Republican state administrations from putting the issue on the ballot at all, since while the issue might not be a major one in determining who people will vote for, if it's on the ballot as a referendum question, it is likely to motivate Democratic voters more strongly to get out and vote, in which case that then could feed through into the outcome. All of these complex computations are now being done. Will abortion be the hot issue that Democrats hope or not? For many other places, it's not just the issues that are hot. Heat waves and droughts. They're all over the place right now. As Japan continues to live through a heat wave that started back in June, it's gotten to the point where insurance companies have introduced specific policies for heat stroke. This because in June, a record number of 15,000 people were taken to hospital with heat stroke, while the country saw what were reported to be the hottest temperatures for the month since 1875. The government's been calling on citizens to stop wearing masks to protect themselves from COVID-19 because it's feared that wearing them during a heat wave actually makes heat stroke more likely. Europe continues also to see high temperatures. Reportedly, supermarkets in Spain are now rationing ice since bars and restaurants are struggling to get enough. Many parts of Spain, including the capital, Madrid, have experienced a record number of days of heatwave, a situation that meteorologists say they expect to continue throughout the whole of August. While the UK citizens were being told to be careful of 41 degrees centigrade temperatures, Spain saw some as high as 44.7 degrees C. This is likely to reduce the olive oil crop, both from Spain and from Italy, parts of which is likewise seeing its worst drought in 70 years. Spain alone accounts for around half of global production of olive oil, and Spain's production of grains, corn, wheat, barley, are expected to decline by 13% this year because of the high temperatures and low rainfall. In the Netherlands, the hot drought conditions are giving rise to special problems thanks to the fact that the country is largely below sea level. Specifically, it's having to divert water to try to prevent its vast network of dikes, which are there to protect against flooding, from completely drying out. A significant number of them are made with peat, which, if it fully dries out, could mean that the dike will break up, which will mean failures when they are once again trying to hold back the waters. In France, meanwhile, nuclear power plants are having to reduce output because the water in nearby rivers is so warm, it's losing its effectiveness as a coolant. This obviously isn't great timing, given the overall energy crisis driving up prices everywhere. But at least the plants are able to still keep producing a significant amount of power despite the problem, which will be good news for Germany's Chancellor Olaf Scholz, who this week, at last, signalled that he would keep the last three nuclear power plants open, a U-turn on the previous position, which was to shut them down at the end of the year. He said that given the need to get alternatives to Russian gas, the move, quote, made sense. No kidding! It seems the German people elected a genius as Chancellor. No way anybody else would have noticed that and have been, you know, banging on about it for maybe the last few months and maybe even years. Even the Greens, part of the governing coalition, have said that they might be up for supporting the idea if they got a policy change in return. A bill that they favour to introduce speed limits on the autobahns. However, all forms of energy are struggling with the heatwave, it seems. The low water levels for the Rhine is likely to disrupt one of Germany's coal-fired power plants, which depends on the river for the delivery of supplies. When a similar situation hit the river in 2018, it alone took 0.2% of German GDP growth, according to Deutsche Bank. Looking big picture of the European heatwave, preliminary data suggests that there have been thousands of additional non-COVID excess deaths recorded during last month's phase of the heatwave. Germany was hit particularly hard, with something like 3,000 non-COVID excess deaths in the week of July the 18th, compared to the average of the last 5 years. Now, that sort of impact was broadly expected, but it's complicated to report. Excess mortality doesn't give an exact death toll for a heatwave, and it will take a lot of retrospective study to establish exact potential causes and effects, particularly since, unlike with COVID-19, heat is not recorded as a likely factor in somebody's death certificate. Also, we'd already noted that there were excess deaths that had gone up. Highly likely that some of that is because of all those deferred tests and treatments from the lockdowns. So you can't just jump to conclusions about excess death periods that coincide with a heatwave, even if the figures show something of a jump, which they do. Still, if we're talking about the impacts of heatwaves on the environment and people, there is at least one piece of encouraging news this week with the release of the latest report on the current state of the Great Barrier Reef. In spite of recent sequences of mass bleaching events, the reef is showing good signs of recovery and is described as having its best coral cover for decades. It's not straightforward, with scientists observing that the regrowth is largely made up of a common, fast-growing, but not especially robust genus, Acropora. It's particularly vulnerable, reportedly, to storms and attacks by crown-of-form starfish, meaning it often grows in boom and bust cycles, so it remains to be seen whether the regrowth is long-lasting and stable in the face of future shocks to the system. But the recovery is sufficiently dramatic to have those scientists agreeing that it's well beyond what was expected, and it suggests that the ecosystem has much greater resiliency and ability to recover than was previously understood. A year ago or so, I did a deep dive on the Great Barrier Reef, and along with the polar bears issue, found that it was one where the critics of the orthodoxy, for example Peter Ridd, had serious points to make that were being unfairly rubbished by some of his opponents. I haven't watched it back recently, but my memory is that it should have aged fairly well with the current situation. I'll put a link to that below if you want to watch it. Does that mean that everything's just tickety-boo and the Great Barrier Reef is safe from everything to come? Well, who knows? Foretelling the future is hard. It's hard enough to look at the evidence and the fake news and all the rest of it today and work out what happened recently, never mind what's going to happen tomorrow. Which turns out to be quite a good bridge for the next bit. If there's one thing my video on Wednesday about the lab leak theory should prove conclusively, it's that this channel is more highly resistant than some to audience capture. What I do here is I look at the questions and the issues that I find interesting, and that tends to be the grey areas, the moral dilemmas, the scientific disputes. I don't pitch for a side, I try to uncover the truth, and I just invite you to join me on the journey. That's not how this alternative ecosystem tends to work, though, and this was a reminder. I'd done half a dozen videos over the last couple of years looking at emerging evidence for a lab leak. A lot of it, albeit all circumstantial, pushed in the direction of it being a serious possibility. My first video was when this wasn't something that respectable people were supposed to talk about, remember? But then with the latest one, some evidence had come to light that pushed the other direction. And because I love serious challenges that push back against something that I believe, I jumped into it. Commenters in YouTube discussion forums don't enjoy that process anywhere nearly as much as I do, apparently. And let's be clear, if I was just chasing subscribers and advertising revenue from views, it would be highly tempting to give in to all of that. Now, Gerwinder Bogal wrote about audience capture and described how it works. For instance, how it transformed YouTuber Nicholas Perry. He started doing videos talking about veganism and playing the violin, and he remained largely ignored. Then he gave up veganism for health reasons and did a few videos of him just eating stuff while talking to the camera as though you were having dinner together. He quickly started to get a bigger audience, and he started to get comments encouraging him to set himself a challenge to eat more of whatever it was he was eating. And he did. And it was insanely popular. And, well, to cut a long story short, he gained 7 million subscribers, and he transformed from this to this. For those who only listen to the audio version of this show, you probably don't even need a description of that. I'm betting you can probably guess. Now, that was a very obvious and visual example, but Bogal also showed how it works with political and other commentary, using the examples of several journalists who followed their online audience into conspiracy rabbit holes, such as Louise Mensch, who got lots of positive audience encouragement for an article in 2016 about Trump's alleged ties to Russia, and kept chasing their approval with more and more outlandish content. So she was recently suggesting that Vladimir Putin assassinated Andrew Breitbart, the founder of Breitbart News, so that his job would go to Trump ally Steve Bannon, for example. And then separately, Majid Nawaz, who started as a perceptive and considered commentator, but again, after getting huge traction on some vague theories about the virus being a fraud, followed where the most energetic of his new followers most wanted to go, and has ended up posting tropes such as resurrected Nazi eugenics programs, satanic rituals, and the Bilderbergers, using numerology as a source of supposed evidence. And Bogal said this specifically in relation to that last example. There is obvious value in investigating unaccountable global organisations, but Majid and his audience are no longer in a position to do this because their symbiotic stupidity has filled their heads with junk info and cost them their objectivity and credibility. Instead of performing real investigations, Majid is now merely performing the role of investigator for his audience, a role that requires drama rather than diligence, and which can lead only to his audience's desired conclusions. That is a phenomenon, I must say, I've seen played out a number of times now. I find a creator who I think has a thoughtful commentary, and then over months before my eyes, it all starts to go a little off the rails of what attracted me to them in the first place. So names like Brett Weinstein and Kim Iverson, various people have fit that pattern. I think the key comes down to something Bogal says next. Although content creators can't choose not to be influenced, they can choose who they are influenced by. I get some comments here saying, Malin is so close. He's got the red pill in his hand. He just hasn't taken it yet. That's one group. Then I get others from people saying, I enjoy this channel, even though I don't agree with everything I see on it, because it challenges me and makes me think. The second group is the one that I seek to be influenced by, because we are on a shared journey of testing things out. We want our ideas to be challenged and to learn by doing so. It's not an instinct that's going to send a video viral anytime soon, but it is at least one that promises to keep us both focused on reality and what is important. No one getting captured, no one being converted or indoctrinated, not the audience, not the creator. That is the definition, in my view, of a healthy relationship for us all to have here on YouTube, and I hope that you agree. Indeed, even some of my Patreon supporters will testify how much they disagree with me on certain issues, which I take as a powerfully positive thing. It's great that they can do that and still want to add that support. Because as you know, without them, this channel would simply not be possible. Which is why I make time at the end of each of these weekly videos to thank the Patreon supporters. They enable me to put the time into making these videos. They enable me to be independent, to not worry about what the audience is going to insist on being the answer, meaning that I can go after what is actually true rather than what is popular. If you would like to add your support for the independent, fact-focused and non-ideological content that I aim to produce here, please head along to patreon.com/Malin Baker. It is always appreciated. Either way, have a great week. My name is Malin Baker. This is the Malin Baker Show. Thanks for watching this video. If you liked it, please share with anyone else you think would also enjoy it. Word of mouth is really important to us. And if you've not subscribed yet, what are you waiting for? As the saying goes, that subscribe button won't smash itself.